here in Pavilion Gardens with Paul Zennon. That's somebody I've wanted to speak to for about 15 years. But I'm going to go back further, and before we talk to you, I'm going to talk about my brother. I grew up in the shadow of a brother who was inducted into the Magic Circle by Ali Bongo.
That's not a euphemism, is it?
No. But I remember growing up, you know, in awe of all of that. And so I'm just going to kind of seek out a romantic story of how you first decided this is what you did.
Right, well, it's funny you should say that, because that's the new show I'm working on is exactly about that. And basically, I kind of grew up near a place called Blackpool in the northwest, a kind of tourist resort, which is about as far away from Brighton as you can get in terms of the style or lack of it. It's kind of like a kind of open Jeremy Kyle theme park with a fistful of glitter thrown at it, you know. But it was really exciting as a kid, and I used to travel there from a couple of hours away and sort of weekends and the school holidays and all the rest of it. And I used to frequent the joke shops and the magic shops. And I ended up meeting a guy called Murray, who was at the time in his mid-70s, and he was had been a very famous Australian escapologist. In fact, he coined the phrase escapology, and he ran a backstreet magic shop, and I kind of bought my first set of linking rings, the Chinese linking ring trick, in there, and that's what kicked it off. But the following summer, I ended up meeting a guy called Bill Thompson, and he opened a new magic shop in Blackpool called the House of Secrets. And I ended up getting a job there, and I worked there every summer for 5 years and kind of learned the trade, so I was kind of proper wizard's apprentice, you know. Mm-hmm. So while doing that and demonstrating card tricks in amongst selling stink bombs and plastic dog poo, getting dragged across the counter by drunken Scottish tourists, I was also doing shows in guest houses and hotels, you know. So as a precocious, well, probably 12 years old onwards, I used to kind of knock on a door and offer to do a free show, and if the guests like it, I'd come back the following week and charge my fiver, you know. So that's where it kicked off, and then when I was 18 or so, I kind of set off and did the spotted hanky on a stick routine and went to the Greek islands and then worked as a street performer for about 5 or 6 months. Did fire eating and magic and all the rest of it. Came back, got a summer season in Jersey, or Club 80 to Dead as we used to call it. And we did 5 months of that, where I was kind of emceeing the show and I sort of brought the comedy in with the magic as well. I've been doing it full-time ever since, really. So, but, you know, in lots of different forms. I mean, these days, you know, there's a lot of work on the corporate scene, the business conferences, that kind of thing. We've done everything from sort of military tours to comedy club circuit to end of the pier summer seasons, you name it, you know.
And going back again to my childhood, I can remember even then, as we watched lots of magic shows, and there was this notion of, you know, each magician has their signature trick or their way that marks them out. So how has your signature developed, and what is the unique signature of Paul Zennon?
Okay, well, I think in the early days, I started off doing, you know, trying to make it funny was always the thing. I like, you know, obvious characters like Tommy Cooper and all the rest of it I was influenced by. And actually, probably early Paul Daniels, when he was kind of a working men's club act when he first made it. He was very sharp comedy-wise at that point. That was my signature thing, was doing the comedy with it. But then I kind of went sideways and did an act of music for a while. I toured with a rock band called Hawkwind for a bit.
I'm a huge Hawkwind fan.
Oh, really? Yeah. I went to their 40th birthday party about 5 years ago, actually. They're still going. I kind of did that for a while, and that's where the name Zennon came from, actually, was doing A-level chemistry while working with Hawkwind, who had this kind of space rock image. But then I'd realised that the kind of trying to do something kind of, I don't know, playing the classic magician or the kind of mystical magician wasn't for me, so the comedy came back into it. And so I suppose signature trick-wise, for a long time, I did a weird routine with bicycle pumps, which is kind of too left-field to describe without vision, I suppose. But these days, I kind of do a trick which is more of a juggling thing than a magic thing, really, which is with a pool triangle, you know, like a snooker frame you put the balls in, attached to a dog lead with a pint of beer stood inside it, and I spin it round my head, which doesn't sound much, and it isn't much, but it is extremely dangerous and feels dangerous. So it's one of those tricks I've been doing for so long now, and it does occasionally go wrong, but if I don't do it, people say, why don't you do it? And if I do it, they say, oh, you're still doing that, you know. But that's become my sort of swan song, I suppose, yeah.
And one more time back to my childhood, I also remember that magic, as it was, you know, it was specifically called magic, even in the entertainment world, always hinted at an unknown world, a mystical world. But it seems like the field has I don't know if it's latched itself or this field has latched onto it, but you know, magic seems to have gone into a melding with mentalism and debunking almost magic and saying, look, this is illusion and there is nothing else, and we can show you how the fakers fake it. I mean, is there still a space for this being the gateway into the unknown?
It's an interesting question. There's all sorts of ways of looking at it, I suppose, because, you know, I've always looked on magic as a form of entertainment, primarily, you know. But there are people that will use the same techniques as magicians and actually tell lies in order to make money. I mean, it's in fact, that's what most people do for a living, use car salesmen, estate agents, politicians, you know. But I think magicians who've got any sort of moral compass do kind of get offended by things like, you know, fake mediums, if that's not a tautology, but, you know, people who pretend that they can contact the dead, you know, and exploit bereaved and grieving people for money. I'm kind of very against that sort of thing, and so you tend to use your powers for good, so to speak. So the reason that magicians get into debunking is because they see it for the nonsense that it is, basically. It was interesting when the street magic thing came around a few years back, probably about 15 years ago now, because that stripped magic back. It took away the show side of it and made it a bit more, you know, it's back to the wow factor, so people were actually thinking that David Blaine maybe could read their mind, and it's the same with Derren Brown now. Derren Brown's slightly different in that he uses that con psychology, the kind of the new age nonsense, your left eye blinked twice and your elbow moved, that means you're thinking of the seven of clubs, you know, and it's all kind of dressing, but it is basically the same tricks that magicians have been doing for centuries, but again he doesn't pretend to have any otherworldly powers. He just hints about the fact that they might exist, you know, while debunking the ones that are actually doing damage using those powers. So I think it's kind of there is a sort of moral responsibility for people in the know to point out, you know, BS, I think we can safely say, when we see it, you know.
So in the mainstream, it's not okay to, you know, say there's such a thing as levitation, or, you know, you can turn base metals into gold and so on. That's all fake, is it?
I think it's fine to say that, but I think anybody with an ounce of common sense realises it's not true, you know. I mean, it's interesting that you get people like Uri Geller or David Icke, I suppose, you know, is a similar kind of character, who will come out with the most outlandish claims, and people will still buy into it, and no matter how many times they're debunked or exposed or caught cheating, people still fall for it, because the bottom line is people want to believe. And I think that's the sort of joy and the danger with magic and the techniques, is that, you know, you are escaping reality, because reality can be quite humdrum, and what you want is a bit of escapism for that, which magic can provide. The problem is that if you start believing that a parallel universe exists with certain, you know, in a real way rather than a fantasy way, that can be dangerous. And the obvious way is when people get involved in the alternative medicine side. So, you know, people go for alternative cancer treatments rather than kind of conventional medicine, because they've watched someone like Uri Geller talking about spiritual healing, you know. And it's a slippery slope, you know. That's an extreme example, but that's the way it works. You know, you might read your horoscope in a newspaper and think it's a bit of a laugh, it's a joke, can't do any harm. But when from that, people go on to believe tarot card readers, they go and see a medium or a psychic, and they end up kind of, you know, paying for treatment that isn't actually doing them any good, and in fact may well be doing a lot of harm.
So a lot of magicians, compared to when I was a child, have clearly come out as skeptics.
Yeah, although it's not a new thing. I mean, you know, famously Houdini was the, you know, the ultimate skeptic. I mean, he actually, oddly enough, believed in God, and he believed in an afterlife. He just didn't believe that anyone could communicate with anyone in the afterlife. And he spent, you know, years debunking mediums, getting fined, losing lawsuits and all the rest of it, getting physically threatened, and, you know, a real hate campaign about him, because obviously the spiritualist movement was massive in the early 20th century because of the First World War in the main. People had lost a lot of their young relatives and were trying to contact them, and he described mediumship as the filthiest profession in the world, and I'm kind of inclined to agree. You know, he'd actually worked as a fake psychic himself in his very early days and was kind of almost ashamed of that, and also he was kind of obsessed with his mother, so when she died I think he was angry with anyone that said he could make contact, because there's nothing in the world he would have liked more than to have made contact with his mother, and the fact that people were prepared to fleece him and thousands of others out of their life savings when they were in a, you know, at the bottom of their ebb, it kind of disgusted him, and I'm inclined to agree. So that's been going on ever since people have claimed to, you know, to be spiritualists, which is the mid-19th century, really. So it's not a new thing, but I think I mean, James Randi famously was doing it in America in the 70s and 80s, exposing the evangelist preachers who were doing healing. And it's carried on since, you know. I mean, say, Uri Geller kept getting exposed by Randi. Nowadays, you know, Derren Brown's an interesting one because he's right on the fence. Although he doesn't say he's psychic, he doesn't often say he's not psychic. He, you know, if you pin him down, he doesn't believe in it at all. But it's not in his interest to alienate his audience who like to believe.
And as we sit here in Pavilion Gardens, there you are, you're in jeans, you're in denims, you're not in black. So when Paul Zenon wakes up, I mean, is this performer that you've been for such a long time, is it a skin you can't take off, or is there another you and this is a costume you put on at some point?
Well, interesting, this almost is a costume because the new show I'm rehearsing today is set in the 70s, so hence the denim and T-shirt.
Like. So you're doing a bit of method acting here.
Yeah, pretty much. And I like to think that my persona on stage is pretty much the same as it is off, so I don't actually really put on too much of a character. I think the only real difference is in real life I am pretty quiet and like sitting on my own in a pub, and I'm quite happy there pottering around on my iPad and all the rest of it. I'm not too gregarious or outgoing, and I don't do magic tricks when I'm not working, you know, when I'm not actually performing. So that's the only difference. But I think personality wise I kind of don't distinguish between the two. I kind of, you know, the onstage version is just a louder version of me.
And as an artist and in a genre, a lot of people, you know, it will be mysterious to them. How are you developing your material? How are you finding what you're going to do? I mean, is that talking to other magicians? Are you looking online? Are you inventing your own tricks? How does it all come together?
Well, interestingly enough, when I was doing a fair bit of TV stuff, you know, I was kind of sort of doing guest spots on Countdown and things like that for 10 years. That eats material, so there's a real need to come up with material on a regular basis, whereas live, there isn't necessarily, because you're always working to different audiences, different parts of the world. But I had a guy, the guy I mentioned previously, Bill Thompson, who ran the magic shop, the House of Secrets in Blackpool, used to look out for stuff for me. So, you know, when stuff came on the market or magicians came up with ideas that they were willing to share, he'd get in touch and go, here's something for you. And he'd also make props for me as well, you know, and I kind of make a few of my own bits as well. But these days, not doing as much TV, I don't have a need to come up with material for live as much. However, that's meant that I've got sort of fairly bored doing the same stuff live, you know. Consequently, I'm doing this new show, which is a real departure for me, which doesn't have any magic in it, or very little magic in it. It's got a couple of tricks. It's more of a drama or a storytelling sort of one-man thing, and that's how I'm kind of staying creative, you know. There comes a point, you know, when you've been doing it as long as I have, that you kind of go in circles and you kind of, you know, I watched a VHS videotape a year or two ago of me on children's TV in the early 90s, and I didn't remember any of the tricks. I was almost fooling myself. I'm thinking, how did I do that, you know? So you can always go back and kind of recycle things, you know. I tend to look at old magic books as well, rather than going, you know, what's the latest DVD produced for magicians. I look at a book from 100 years ago and, you know, there's a trick with powdered egg, and you think, oh, maybe I could adapt that and do that with something, you know, that's relevant today. So I think that, you know, a lot of magicians recycle in the same way that musicians do. You know, it's like jazz, it's the same sort of format, but you get an old classic and put your own twist on it, you know, or set the chords in a different sequence. So I don't think there's a real need to totally reinvent the genre all the time, but I think, you know, I often get inspired in weird places as well. You might just spot something in a toy shop or a hardware shop and think, oh, there's an idea, I could do something with that, you know. But I say, at the moment I'm kind of really enjoying kind of working on things that are, it's a, you know, about magic but not actually trick based.
And so in terms of then your build up to a new show, if we followed you around, what are we seeing?
You see me this week panicking. Yeah, basically you'd see my house as a mess, you know, the sort of, you know, with all the best will of having the garage as the workshop and all the rest of it, it's now, it ends up in the living room, and so there's sticky tape and cardboard and paint everywhere, lots of weird props. I'm always trying to have a clear out. I've got so much junk I've collected over the years, but inevitably a new show you think, oh, I might need that'd work, so it's back on eBay and filling up the cupboards again. But aside from that, I tend to do very little formal rehearsal, you know. Today being an exception, but normally I would just potter around late at night at home. I'm very nocturnal, is one, you know. I don't often do mornings. My kind of general work time is between 10 at night and 3 in the morning generally, so that's and it is, it's almost like a sort of adult at play, really. You know, you've got the prop, you've got an object, you've got an end point you want to get to, and you just mess about till it kind of works. But the only real way of kind of working on stuff is in front of an audience, unfortunately. And so as I'm about to experience tomorrow, there's that terrifying thing of doing an entirely new new show from scratch and having absolutely no idea whether it's going to work technically or how it's going to go down, you know. But I guess that's the adrenaline rush that we got into it in the first place for, you know.
And then in terms of where you go with that afterwards, so when you're on tour, do you then kind of say, right, I know you're going to vary the material because you have different audiences, but the tricks, whatever they are, is it printed like a script or do you change it as you go?
No, it's very adaptable. I mean, it's kind of, you kind of hang the gags, the material around the tricks, obviously. So you might set off and go, well, I have to do 15 minutes on a theatre show or whatever, so that's roughly three or four tricks. You'll put them in sequence, try it one night, and one of them doesn't quite work, so you replace that. Something in the audience happens at a certain point you weren't expecting, and you get a line out of it that you've ad-libbed, so you keep that in the next night. So it's a very organic thing. But basically, you've got a skeleton of an act in your mind, and then you just kind of hang the lines on that, and that develops throughout a tour, you know.
What's your favourite trick?
I don't particularly have a favourite as such. The triangle trick I mentioned previously, I tend to close the show on because it is sort of fairly big, quite spectacular and quite dangerous, and it's hard to follow. But I've also got an opening trick that I generally do, which is using the cable on the microphone. So it's a version of the old cut and restored rope trick. You cut it in half, it ends up back together. But I do it with a microphone cable, so there's a slight danger with the electrical element, and also your voice cuts out as you cut it. And those two tricks, the triangle and that, tend to be the sort of top and tail of most things to do, and it's because they're reliable. I know them inside out, so I can be thinking about the audience and the venue and my other lines while I'm doing them, and it's kind of a surefire thing. It's just the hour in between that I have to worry about, you know.
And then I guess final question would be, are you going to be doing this forever? Is there a journey for you that you can see ahead?
It's an interesting question, because I kind of in some ways think there's nothing sadder than an ageing variety turn, you know, which I am. But on the other hand, you know, I've got a mate who's a 94-year-old pickpocket magician called Mark Raffles, who lives in Blackpool, and he's still working, and you've got to admire that, you know. So part of me thinks it's basically the buzz of being on stage that I like. So I think that in terms of progress, I think I'd like to change what I'm doing so it's not just an out-and-out trick monkey. I'd like to do a bit more acting, which I'm doing now, and you know, carry on the comedy, the presenting stuff. I think it's the variety within the job that I enjoy, so I think I'll always be doing something connected, but not necessarily just doing card tricks, you know.
Paul Zenon, thanks very much.